On December 31st, 2019, the World Health Organization's office in China heard the first reports of a previously unknown virus behind a number of pneumonia cases in the city of Wuhan. On March 11th, 2020, that virus, now named COVID-19, better known as the coronavirus outbreak, was now characterized as a pandemic by the World Health Organization. Today, the New York Times wrote, "The number of known coronavirus cases in the United States continues to surge. As of Tuesday afternoon, at least 5,000 people in 49 states, plus Washington, D.C., and three U.S. territories have tested positive for the coronavirus. According to the New York Times database, at least 93 patients with the coronavirus have died. The pace of diagnosis is expected to quicken as the virus spreads and testing becomes more widely available. More state and private labs have started running tests for the coronavirus in recent days, increasing the capacity to identify new patients after weeks of delays and testing kits shortages." Today on Twitter, Speaker Pelosi said the Family First bill was about many things, but first and foremost, it's about testing, testing, testing. She urges senators to pass the legislation today to make testing free and to provide masks and make them available ASAP. While we wait on relief legislation to be passed by our federal government, the CDC have advised us to wash our hands often with soap and warm water for at least 20 seconds, to use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer with at least 60% alcohol if soap and water are not available, to cough or sneeze inside a tissue, or to cough and sneeze into your elbow, but not your hand, to stay home as much as possible, and social distancing can help slow the spread. These are confusing and scary times. And so, like many of you, I wanted a bit more clarity about what this virus is and why it's so difficult to find a vaccine. So I turned to my friend, Dr. Hazel Levy, who is a virologist and a research scholar in the biomedical sciences, in STEM education, and in higher education policy. She was the first Black American woman to have an independent and National Institutes of Health-funded research laboratory in the history of the University of Florida's College of Medicine. Dr. Levy is a social justice community organizer, serving as the vice chair of the Woman of Color Caucus of National Women's Liberation, Gainesville, Florida chapter, and was a founding faculty advisor to UF's Black Women in Medicine student organization. Here is our conversation. So I think I told you that I had been watching a couple of virologists on television speak about this virus, and a lot of them have kind of said a little bit about what they know, but a lot are unknown. Can you just let me know what a virologist is and what it is that you do?
So virologists generally are scientists that study viruses, and viruses vary so widely for basically every living thing. There's a different virus or a different set of viruses that can infect that living thing. You know, even inside of us, we have different kinds of cells, and different types of viruses can just infect certain types of cells and not others. So depending on what virus you study, like, for example, I study parvoviruses and picornaviruses, and they're just tiny ones, and I'm interested in them because they're used, they're basically engineered to be used as treatment strategies or as therapies. And so that's kind of the virology stance that I use, is basically taking this thing, taking this basically in a case of parvoviruses, it's like a protein shell that's sort of like spherically shaped with a little bit of nucleic acid on the inside. In the case of parvos, that it's DNA on the inside. And I'm basically trying to study that as best as you can to figure out how does it get into cells. And in our case, the parvoviruses that I work on do not cause a disease. And so we try to engineer them so that they can, for example, attack cancer cells. So virologists generally are scientists that study viruses. But there's so many viruses that your areas of expertise could really vary.
So why has this virus in particular been so baffling? Because to me, this has been one that has really scared medical professionals. It has left a lot of people baffled on how to attack it. Obviously, our American response has been a lot slower than in other countries. Why do you think a disease like this one in particular, this virus, has been so baffling?
I think that it's highly infectious. And so the spread of it, the quickness of its pandemic spread, I think is something that is surprising and alarming. But moreover, you don't really learn about a virus until it's kind of come and gone. It's really difficult to know everything about it until sort of the disease and the spread has kind of come and gone so that you can study everything, right? So you're sort of building the bike while you ride it when you are fighting something that is actually killing people, right? And so I think a lot of viruses we don't have adequate antivirals for. I don't think that that's really unique, to be honest. When something is novel or newly emerged, like in the case of this virus, which is believed to have been transferred from other animals into humans, and that's why it's novel, because it hadn't previously been passed into humans. Of course, the virus has been evolving for a very long time in whatever its host previously was, but something shifted just enough to where it could now get into human cells, right?
So people have thought that this might have started from animals. So that is very interesting to me. And the reason it's novel, it's because it's new. This is something, because I think a lot of people are seeing this language around this virus and don't understand it.
So novel meaning it's a newly emerged in humans. It doesn't mean it's not been around before, but that's how I see it, as it just recently jumped from a different animal host to being able to infect. And so, like, you've probably seen images of the coronavirus, right? And it has these spikes that come off of it. And those spikes basically determine which cells it can get into and out of. And it's made out of proteins. And then the proteins are encoded for by the genetic material that's inside. In the case of this coronavirus, it's RNA. So as the genes, as the RNA of the virus evolve over time, those protein spikes will be different, right? And so essentially, those spikes evolved in such a way where they were able to trick a human cell into allowing the virus in.
That's wild. So those little red dots around it, those are protein spikes then. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So this particular virus has what's called an envelope, which has, it's a lipid membrane that's around it. And embedded in this lipid membrane are these protein spikes. And so it's an envelope virus. Most of the viruses I study are non-envelope viruses. They're very different.
So people have talked about this being kind of similar to the flu, but much more deadly than the flu. How is it determined that it's similar to another virus? How is that determined?
So my understanding with people saying it's similar is that it also causes like an upper respiratory disease, right? And that also, so some of the symptoms, having a cough, having a fever, that's kind of flu-like. Also the transmission, that it can be passed by human-to-human contact. So some of that, like, it doesn't require like intravenous blood transfer, for example. So that's what I think people mean when they say that it's like the flu, but they're actually rather different structurally and classification-wise, different viruses.
Now, people right now they're starting some clinical trials. Why is it so difficult to try to come up with a vaccine like this? I don't think people understand why it's so difficult.
So this might be a little out of my wheelhouse, but I wouldn't mind just taking a stab at it, just kind of because I, you know, finding a vaccine for something means you are able to create a molecule of some sort that will trigger a person's immune response to attack this particular virus, right?
Right.
I think some of the difficulty in making this is not so much the methodologies, but it's in the system, getting it approved and going through the sequence of trials, safety checks, and all of this takes a really long time and is labor intensive and expensive. So the process itself of getting something approved to be used in human beings in the United States anyway is in itself difficult, not to mention that the methodology to actually create the substance or the therapy or whatever, or the so in some cases we use viruses and we sort of inactivate them so that they're not infectious anymore. And then you still have some of these structural motifs. That's what you're trying to create antibodies against. So you expose a person to some piece of this virus and then your body recognizes it and creates antibodies to fight it. So there's a recognition that goes on in your immune system when a vaccine is used, right? So, or you could, in some cases, you could just take a piece, like, I don't really know if this is what's going on, but you could take like some of those spike proteins and use that as the molecule that elicits the immune response from people. So something about it, some physical piece of material that resembles the virus is probably going to be needed to make a vaccine.
And today was the first time I've heard of the word safety check, actually, was in some of the trials. They were explaining it as making sure the person that was in the trial was checking on them to making sure they weren't having any adverse reactions. And I guess that's why it's risky, because this is kind of an unknown what you're doing to someone. How are you all... you know, I'd say maybe some of your colleagues, how are you all discussing this right now? I'm sure it's a hot topic, even for those, as you say, aren't specifically studying this virus. What are some of the conversations that you're having with maybe other virologists about this?
Well, I know some work that's going on at the University of Florida right now. They're actually trying to look at molecules that exist already. So there's antivirals, which is something that you basically use to treat if you've already got this virus, right? Versus a vaccine that's used to make it so that your immune system can fight off a virus when it encounters it, right? So two different things. Once you're sick, you're going to be treated with antivirals to help get rid of your system symptoms and clear the virus out of you. But if you had a vaccine, that would kind of prevent you from getting infected, right? So so there is some work going on right now at the University of Florida. We're looking at molecules that can be used as antivirals, as therapies for sick people. And what they're looking at are molecules that are already FDA approved to treat other viruses, right? So there's all kinds of molecules that are out there, all kinds of therapies that are used to treat different diseases, right? So what would be great, what would be best if we could find something that's already been approved, already gone through safety trials in people that could also be used to combat this particular virus. Maybe one molecule or a combination of a few therapies together, that would be ideal. So that's some of the discussion that I've been hearing, is what do we have already in our arsenal that we haven't thought to use against this novel coronavirus that we've never encountered before?
So there was... Dr. Richard Hatcher, he's from the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. And he said that this is the most frightening disease he had ever encountered in his career. And he included Ebola, MERS, and SARS. And he says it's frightening because of the combination of infectiousness and lethality that appears to be manifold higher than the flu. What are some of your personal concerns that you felt about this disease?
My concern, as someone who would kind of want to like protect herself and her community with information and knowledge, like the lack of testing, I find to be problematic. And that, and like, to me, it's a little, it's like unscientific in a way when we're dealing with a pandemic to not like get as many people tested as possible. Like waiting for people to have symptoms to present and then to have them come in and be tested to confirm cases. I don't see that as a great strategy for curbing a pandemic spread. I feel like throwing a large net, seeing which healthy people are carrying the virus, seems to me to be a better strategy, right? So that's, right. I don't know. I think right. different states are I think different sense. States yeah. are dealing with it differently, but it feels like here in the state of Florida, you can't just go, me and my daughter and my partner can't just go out and get tested right now and say, okay, we're good. So we can go, you know, help other people, or we can just be counted as folks that don't, that aren't spreading this at this point. Right. But that's not what's being, that's right. not what's happening right now. We really don't know how many people. So like, it's impossible to really know what, at what rate does this virus cause disease? Like how many of us are asymptomatic? We don't know that unless we test more of us. How deadly is this virus? Who's sick with it? How can we really count that unless we're doing more widespread testing so we can figure out how many people have it and then how many people are getting really sick or dying from it, right? Until you have a larger net cast, it's impossible to even really make those numbers.
So Robert Klain, I believe his last name is, he's the ex-Ebola czar for Obama's White House, said we are seeing a failure of competence and confidence that we're far behind other countries in testing. And if I were back in my old job in the White House, I'd be pushing for us to do 30 million tests. So as you said, you'd want to kind of see right now and as part of testing who is healthy right now or even why. I mean, they've discussed that children have been asymptomatic, but that are carriers right now. What would your ideal protocol be? You kind of listed a little bit what you would start with. What are some of the other tools you think that you would try to enact if you were in a position to be able to implement those?
Well, one of my main concerns right now is like the economic burden on people. I'm concerned for people's physical health and safety, but I'm also concerned for the economic burden on people that work for hourly wages, people that are small business owners, and people in the service industry. So one thing I would love to see happen, this if I ruled the world, is to have all the kids tested. All these kids that aren't in school right now, I would love right. to see them all tested, because I would sure really like to send them back to school. And then just send them home, send them to school, home, test everyone, get them in, send them to school and home. And then test them regularly. Because that to me, I think people can do their jobs better, or they can help each other better, or healthcare workers can do their jobs better if our kids who aren't getting sick from this are being taken care of.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm trying to figure out, too, why there are so many obstacles in testing. I know that there is a power struggle at the federal level of our government right now, and that we had been offered tests, I believe, from the German government. And I know that Trump had looked at buying some patents for them that would only be here in America. But other than that, what possible reason could there be for not having tests everywhere? Is it, I mean, I don't know if you
I don't
know.
Understand it.
Okay. Yeah.
It's because a really good question, because I mean, I appreciate, so this is an RNA virus. Okay. So getting the RNA out of an RNA virus is not trivial. RNA is not as sturdy and hardy as DNA is. So that's kind of the first thing, is you have to find a way to get this RNA intact out of the virus. I see that could be an obstacle for a really easy test. But right now the protocols are PCR-based tests, which is a molecular method where the sequence of this virus has been known. Creating primers is what they're called, these small little pieces of DNA that you need to kind of target the virus in order to kind of test for its presence. Those are really not expensive to make. The enzymes that you need to run these tests, those are a bit more expensive. Like, it's really not clear to me what are the real obstacles to this. I feel like people could make this in their labs, like, and what kind of throughput can, I mean, these are sort of methods that are widely used and right. understood, you know, PCR-based methods. And so I don't really get what is the hang up, why we can't have more widespread testing.
I don't either. And it's been frustrating. Would you mind also explaining again, just touching on DNA versus RNA? I mean, I know it's an RNA, you said before, is like a single strand. I just want to make sure that my listeners understand the difference between that.
So this, so DNA and RNA are both nucleic acids. They're both genetic material. And normally in your cells, in yours and my cells, our DNA is sort of stored or housed in the nucleus, right? And that's where it's kind of kept. And but the action of the DNA does not reside inside the nucleus. We need proteins to get made all over the cell and even to be removed from the cell at some point, right? So the product of genes is our DNA or our proteins. That's how genes get carried out, through the action of proteins. And so we rely on RNA to be like, so the kind of the way I tell my students is like, you have this library of books, right? Well, when you need to take an exam, you don't need every single book from the library, right? You just need this volume or that. So RNA kind of makes a copy of whatever genes are needed right then. You don't need every single gene to be working in every cell at all times. That's actually what distinguishes different cell types. Certain cells are using some of your genes, and other cells are using other kind of collections of your genes. That's why we have so many kinds of cells, because we're using different collections of genes in these different cell types. So the point I'm trying to make is that you rely on RNA to basically translate those genes in the nucleus into some action out in the cytoplasm. So it's out in the cytoplasm beyond the nucleus inside your cell where RNA actually gets translated into protein. Okay, and so RNA by nature is a temporary molecule. You don't always need the same proteins to be made. It has like a half-life by nature. So it's a more easily degraded molecule than DNA, which is a lot more stable. And so that's what I say is one of the, I can see as one of the hurdles to making this test really cheap, I guess, is that it's expensive to isolate that RNA and keep it intact before we enter into the PCR process.
And so that is probably the main reason, if there is a reason why it's harder to get these tests.
I really don't think so. I'm stretching really hard to come up with a reason.
Okay. Basically, we should have all these tests and that other countries
I think
have
so.
Them, you know?
Well, I mean, my husband is an economist and he was making a really good point last night that we've actually been seeing sort of economic growth since the previous recession or the larger recession. And like, it's just amazing that we have no social safety net now. Like it's being exposed so clearly that we don't have that. Like we could have been being prepared for something like this, but instead we don't have social safety nets for people, including healthcare.
Absolutely. The social safety nets have been diminished and almost non-existent in some areas. And then also Trump cut the pandemic response team apparently in 2018. So there wasn't a couple of huge things in place for something like this. And just so that my audience knows, when does a virus or disease, when is it considered a pandemic? And I know that it is considered now, but when does that classification come into being?
I don't know the exact, what the exact classification is, but my understanding is that it's globally spread. Like, I feel like epidemics is mm-hmm. like more regional specific, and pandemic kind of means that we have a bunch of linked epidemics of the same virus.
That makes sense. I just like to for us to be kind of rooted in these understandings. I think that sometimes during this kind of crazy time, words get thrown around, but people don't get to sit and think what was actually going on. So right now, how do you think Florida has handled this this response right now? Because in New York, our governor has been getting a lot of praise for doing kind of daily briefings and treating this very seriously, although I think we have the most reported cases right now. The death rate is lower, but it's still, you know, it's still high in keeping with the numbers of this disease. How has Florida's response, do you feel, has been so far?
Well, the response primarily has been to shut things down and to focus on individual people's behaviors, social distancing. And I think that we should be doing wider testing for people. And I think that getting kids back in school, it could be better thought about, but instead they're really comfortable with asking people not only to work from home, but also care for their children at the same time. I mean, so many people are still expected to do their same jobs. Like those of us that are fortunate enough, that's how we're supposed to feel. We're fortunate enough to still do our jobs, but do them at home while we're also caring for our kids. I mean, it's just, it's untenable. But I mean, we, in Alachua County anyway, the number of cases is quite low.
Right.
And the social distancing has been pretty effective.
So, but
as far as the state in general goes, I think it's really still, I go to the website constantly. I'm always going to the health department website and the state website and trying to find information. And early on, they were having like a sort of a chart that showed you every single case that was coming up and the age of the person that was getting it. I think there was like maybe like assigned sex or something, and then how they receive or how they got the virus, or is it under investigation, or is it travel related? And I noticed that chart has, sorry, I just pushed my microphone, is no longer being updated. So early on, I thought that there was more information. I feel like there's less information over time, fewer updates. And so, for example, we got an update today that four students from the University of Florida were tested positive for the virus, right? For this coronavirus, but all of our students, many of our students have been sent home, wherever home is, or and so none of that information was shared. Are these students that are actually in Alachua County? Are these students that are in their home counties? Like, there's just a lot of gaps in the information, and there's almost like a lack of trust in the public in a way, like as if we can't handle real information. That's how it feels sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that has been kind of the consensus of how the federal government overall has handled it, in the sense that they don't want to see the real numbers, because I think once testing does go wide, and I'm really hoping that it does after this package is approved in the Senate. What I want to know from you, and I just have only like one or two questions left, is, you know, obviously the CDC has given us some advice about what to do. Do you think, besides the hand washing and using alcohol-based hand sanitizer, if soap and water is not available, how to cough and sneeze into a tissue or into your elbow, or staying home or social distancing, is there anything else that you can see doing? Like, is there actual ways to boost your immune system if you're kind of already a decently healthy person? I know for some that are already having pre-existing conditions, that this is an extra scary time. But do you have any kind of like recommendations or advice on that?
Well, kind of not fun ones when you're cooped up, but like smoking and drinking, I think, are two things that you can stop doing if you're concerned particularly about a respiratory virus, right? So I think that's a really important a way to help your immune system is to not smoke or drink alcohol, which I think feels a little impossible when you're cooped up. I don't really know. But I've been using like Emergencies with zinc in them, and I have tried to read some studies, and I don't know that I've seen really good studies that show that with this particular novel coronavirus, what do we really know about it? All you can really use is your conventions about the other coronaviruses that we get all the time, or with influenza or something like that, right? So all you can really do is make guesses because we have not, because this virus is novel, we have not really studied it, right? And so so things that you normally do to boost your immune system. I mean, I've been going for walks and, just trying to eat as healthy as I can. But I think those are just I think the answer to your question is no, I really don't know.
No, I think a lot of people don't right now. And so you said there are other coronaviruses. Is this why the number, why we have a number assigned at the end of it, of out of COVID-19? Is that why it's called 19?
There's different, just like there's different strains of influenza, right? Last year we saw H1N1 again. Now that's called kind of like the regular boring old influenza is H1N1 now, you know. Yeah, there's different strains of viruses, and they are distinguished by their genetic markers or by differences in their protein structures, right? Or different antibody responses that they elicit. They're called serotypes, which means that they elicit a different collection of antibodies from animals that they're tested in or something like that. We get coronaviruses. Coronaviruses are one of the common cold viruses, right? But this one just happens to be a new strain in humans.
So, and this is the last question I'll ask you. Why do you think some people still haven't really taken this seriously? Like, if they kind of knew what you know, which is a lot, and thank you, you've been incredibly informative, would they take it a little bit more seriously if they knew what you knew?
You know, my thoughts on this is that people, we're taught this individualism in our society, and we're not taught to think about what can we do to make sure our neighbors are safe, you know? And so my thought is this, like, no one in my house is really in this, in the group of people that are high risk, right? But I am not interested in being a part of the problem, right? And so I'm willing to, I'm complaining about my inconveniences. I know that people have significantly worse inconvenience than even what I'm experiencing, obviously, right? Whether they're very sick or whether they are reliant on their wage jobs and not able to get to work, right? Or having to choose between caring for their kids or sending their kids to a daycare that they're not comfortable with and going to work, right? So people are making really tough choices. And if I can just stay out of it enough to flatten the spike in infectivity or in infection rates, then I feel like it's worth doing my part. But similarly, I would be interested in having some of my tax monies or whatever be used to have healthcare for every single person in the whole entire country. It's just the way we think, you know. It almost reminds me too, here in Florida, people don't like to wear like winter coats because they don't want to look cold. It's like this fear of looking too something, you know. I was like, I luckily have no shame whatsoever, so I don't mind looking too prepared or something like that.
Well, I really appreciate your thoughts on this. This has been great. I learned a lot about it. So thank you for that. And I know that my audience will too. I think one of the things is people want to just know more what this is or how it forms or, you know, how it functions or why there are so many obstacles, you know? So I appreciate it. And I don't know if you have any last thoughts. Otherwise, I thank you so much for doing this.
I actually have two kind of parting thoughts, and this has just to do with having talked to like my friends or people in my community. But like, I think it's important to kind of learn like sort of the realities of this virus. For example, people are like worried about being reinfected, right? And we have to be very skeptical about this kind of thing, because what I've been reading is that viruses can have certain reservoirs or certain places in your body where they hide. So if you're having, if your viruses are not hiding in your nasal passages or in your airways, and that's where the doctor swabs you to test you, then you may turn out negative, right? But right. You could still have the virus in you. And then if you present again with the virus, then they're like, oh, she was reinfected. What does reinfected really mean, right? Right. Are you still just having that same virus, but it just was undetected and now it's detected again? So I just want people to be a little bit more skeptical about the things that they read, right? The other thing right. is how long do these viruses really last on surfaces? There are, I think the CDC just put out some or maybe it was the National Institutes of Health. I was just reading something where it's like it can, you know, some people are like, oh, it lasts for, you know, 10 days on things. No, it doesn't. It can last for a day. And the more porous or scratched or something is, the more places for the viruses to hide, the more they can stay in a wet enough environment to survive. But wow. on flat surfaces, they're not going to really last for more than a day or two, you know, however, I just want people to be logical with their preparation and to just, you know, when, if you can, right?
Right. No, that makes absolute sense. And, you know, not to get too, I think people are incredibly worried about even just leaving their house at all. Some people that are, you know, feeling asymptomatic. I'm not talking about going and gathering in crowds, but forgetting to go get fresh air, you know, during right. this time. You know,
fresh air is perfectly fine.
Yes, yes. Well, that's very good to hear, because I'm going to do that at some point today myself.
All right. Thank you so much. Yeah, I really enjoyed talking with you, Maya. And
always. This is Maya Contreras. Thanks for taking the time to listen to this episode of Obscene. Until next time.